Well, first, thank you all so very much for having me. It's a great honor to be here. As you heard, I'm a member of the Common Ground Meditation Center community, and you know, we look at our sister Sangha here over in St. Paul really as a source of inspiration for a number of things, and how you all are so actively continuing to work and build community, particularly around issues that are challenging our nation at this time. And just taking head-on issues of race, diversity, equity, inclusion, these, and all doing it really rooted in the teaching of the Dharma. It's a great source of inspiration for us all. And again, an honor and a privilege to be able to be here. I think I might like it a little too much, and that having someone help you with everything while you're teaching, I'm going to go back and tell our guiding teacher, get Coming Ground. I was like, and then he brought me water, Mark. What have you brought me lately, Mark? So, before we get into this, I really think that the Dharma and the healing that's possible takes place in the context of community. We could all be at home right now listening to Dharma Seed or Dharma Talk on YouTube, but you've chosen to come here on a Sunday to do this work. So as I mentioned in the meditation, to honor that, to really take a moment and pause and be like, yeah, this is a noble thing that I'm doing. I am contributing to the liberation of all beings by this radical act of taking care of the heart-mind. To further do that in community, we'll do something a little different here. Hopefully no one will throw a stone at me. But all I want is just you turn to a person next to you, preferably somebody you didn't come in knowing or knowing so well, and just check in, 30 seconds. Your name and what made you smile this week? Your name and what made you smile this week, so please. Look at that, he's rang the bell twice, everybody got quiet. I am really telling Mark we need to make some changes at Common Ground. So just take a moment and feel into how the room feels in this moment. All right? A little less like a bunch of individuals that came into the room to do this work alone, and a little more like community of individuals that have a shared intention of healing our heart minds, and recognizing that that shared intention is something that the person to your left has, the person to your right, the person behind you and in front of you. Like, we all suffer, first noble truth. We all suffer. And we all need healing in our lives. And that is what brings us through the door of the Sangha, is recognizing that there's something that in this place offers healing. We intuit that this is a place where the heart can relax, where the heart can find ease, where the challenges of this world that threaten to break us at times can find some degree of space so that we can move forward through the white waters of this thing called life. Today, I wanted to talk about a lady named Patacara, who was a contemporary of the Buddha. She was one of the most renowned nuns of the time. And you know, it's said that she eventually ended up developing various powers and beautiful things in her life that, in helping to teach many people and bring the Dharma to them. But her story didn't begin there. In the same way that we all can look at our lives and see that there's a degree of oftentimes a degree of ease, a degree of beauty that we offer as to people in our world, like whether it's a kind word to a friend or whether it is the ability to listen and be a source of inspiration or healing to the world around us. Quite often we know that those gains, those benefits that we've gained, those merits that we've cultivated, were not bestowed upon us by some dove from above, but they come through the work of living this life. They are the stripes of the challenges that we have endured through our time here on this spaceship. In the same way, Patacara, this amazing, renowned nun, her story starts well before that, when she was a girl of in her mid-teens, and she came from a wealthy family. Her parents wanted her to marry another young man from another wealthy family, but she fell in love with a stable boy. Her and the stable boy ran away from the village that her parents were living in and got married. Eventually, she'd get pregnant, and as she was ready to deliver, she wanted to go back home to her parents' home in order to have her baby. The husband said, "Well, if we go back to your parents' place, your parents will kill me because I'm the poor stable boy who stole their daughter." So he was against the idea. One day he's off at work, and she begins to make her trek to go back home. At that time, she ends up having the baby on the road. The husband runs to go find her, and then they come back to their home where they live for the next couple years until Patacara gets pregnant again. When Patacara does get pregnant again, same thing, she wants to go to her husband's home, her parents' home, to have the baby. The husband protests. Once again, he's away, and she leaves to go to her parents' home. On the journey, he catches up with her. She's pregnant and not too flight of foot. And they run into a storm. And in that storm, they can't go any further. The river's all washed out. Patacara says, "Go make me a shelter so we can weather this storm." As the husband is off making the shelter, he gets bitten by a snake and he dies. Patacara ends up delivering her baby by herself, and not knowing what to do in that moment, she takes the babies and she makes a little shelter there and tries to just manage for the evening. Sorry, I should always preface this story with the arc of this story is not one that, it's a challenging story to hear, and it's about suffering. And I should say that because oftentimes when we throw our Western ears to hear a story, and so then this is how they won the day. But of course, this is a story that of a person's actual life, and the Buddha told it for a different reason, so I wanted to preface that. As Patacara wakes, morning she goes, she takes her two really infants and begins looking for a husband and finds him dead, bitten by a snake. She's stricken by grief, no doubt feeling some degree of challenge or questioning her own self, like, how did this happen? But she recognizes her going back home to her husband's home at this point makes no sense, so she'll move forward to go to her parents' home. Again, the river is swollen from the rains, so she's not able to take both babies across at the same time. She takes one of the children across, places the child on the far bank of the river. As she's coming back for the second child, she's in the middle of the river, and a hawk is swirling above and comes down and attacks the first child, the brand new infant. She starts screaming, understandably, as her infant is being attacked by a hawk. The toddler at that moment thinks his mother is calling for him, and in his own state of confusion, rushes into the water and also drowns. So now, Potiphar has lost her husband. She's lost both of her children through sheer strength of her own will. She is able to get herself out of the river and continue on towards her hometown. On her way to her hometown, she meets a man from Savathi, I believe is the name of the town, or her hometown. And she asks him, "Hello, traveler, you know, tell me what's going on in that place, in the home, my hometown. Oh, it was hit by a major storm. Many people lost their lives." And she says, there's smoking in the distance. She's like, "Well, what about these people? What about these people?" Finally, she asks, like, "What about, I don't know, these people, the Joneses?" And the traveler's like, "Ask me about anybody except for the Joneses." And she's like, "No, tell me about them. And he says, "Well, you see that pyre of smoke there?" He's like, "Yeah, well, that's their home, because last night, the storm came and hit their home, and all their relatives were killed." And Patakara says, "Oh my goodness, that's my family. That's where I'm going." And it is at that moment that Patakara hits her breaking point, where she quite literally, under the weight of the traumas that she has endured, that have built up over time, where she is unable to manage, handle the weight of it all, and internally she collapses, she folds, and she has a split from reality. The text says she loses her mind. And for some time after that, she was what many of us would call psychotic. She was no longer part of society. She was treated as an outcast. She ran around naked and would stayed in the woods. She wasn't able to engage with humans anymore. And she was, people would see her, she wasn't able to engage. Like, and initially there was some wanting to help, but she would, she was understandably like angry, and she couldn't navigate, and so that she would have these fits of rage, and people would end up like throwing rocks at her and ushering her away from the town. And then one day the Buddha was making his concert tour through the area, and the people in the town were like, "Listen, we don't know what we can do for this woman. There's nothing that we've tried our best. Let's see if the Buddha can work, can do anything for her." And as the Buddha's disciples see her coming from afar, they're like, "Oh no, that's the crazy lady. Keep her away. Like, she's naked. What's she gonna do? He's a holy man, and she's naked." And but the people of the town are like, "No, like, she needs the healing that we know is possible in that space. We know that by taking her amongst the community of other individuals doing this work, by having her meet the Buddha, maybe there's something there." They intuited that maybe there's a way for her to come back to herself, to have a sense of wholeness, to have a sense of restoration of the heart-mind. And when the Buddha sees her, it says that he first listens deeply. my daughter, tell me what's going on. How are you like this? Like, tell me. And so she tells him what's going on. And after telling him what's going on, him listening, imagine connecting on a very deep level with her and her suffering. He says, sister, regain your presence of mind. Regain your presence of mind. And the story says in that moment, you know, in a twinkling of an eye, she was able to regain the presence of mind that had eluded her for so long. She was able to come back. Her mind was restored to her previous state. And she was able to see how fragmented and disheveled and, you know, strewn about her life had become. And then the Buddha asked some of the sisters in the Sangha to literally to clothe her, to wrap themselves around her, to give her clothes, to feed her, to embrace her as one of their own. And from that deep sense of gratitude for Sangha and that deep sense of belonging and of homecoming in her own body, in her own self, and then with others, she was able to move forward. And from there, from that tremendous amount of heartache, pain, trauma, she would later become one of the most renowned nuns and teachers in tradition for literally centuries to come. We're speaking about her now. The breaking point. So we all want to be of service in this world in some way. We all want to be the person that can help serve, offer the kind word, offer the good thing to the world around us. But don't nobody want to suffer. And understandably so. Like the things that Patakara went through, the thing, the challenges that she endured, like who would wish them upon anyone? I wouldn't wish them upon my worst enemy. And there's so much to see and learn from this story. You know, for me, like I've been, so this year has been a year of Patakara in my life. Like it was, I would love if this was like a year of triumph and of victory, and everything had just gone the way I had wanted it to. I had all my plans over the last year written up on my bathroom mirror, saying my intentions all the time. And a buddy of mine is like, you know, if you want to hear God laugh, you know, tell him your plans. Last time I tell you what's going on. But life has a very real way of throwing curveballs at us all. And despite our best laid intentions and giving our best, the first noble truth is a fact of this life. There is suffering. There is not a one of us who has not been touched by this thing of suffering. And just show our hands. Anyone who has suffered in this life, just hand raise, please. All right, good. Thank you. Anyone who hasn't suffered, I was going to invite you to take your leave. Or the Dhamma seat if you'd like. But suffering, it's something that I don't have a fictitious and overly ennobled idea of suffering. I don't believe that it is this thing that makes us into these tremendous and great beings inherently in and of itself. It's a, it has that value. I think that I did at one point. In one point in my life, I thought that the more suffering a person had, the more noble they were. And the more that they could endure, the better quality of human being they were. Until I had my first nervous breakdown. Then I was like, yeah, that's not true. And quite interestingly, it was, you know, it was in college, going through, I was doing a bunch on campus. I was, it was my junior year, maybe I was student teaching. I was captain of the varsity basketball team. I was leading all this stuff on campus. I had no idea of self-care, no idea of what it meant to find balance and ease, and I was doing way too much. And remember, I was trying to, that semester, get straight A's, and that was the goal. And I'd gotten a D on a test in my instructional design class. Yeah, a D. And, you know, I don't know what Dr. Zook was thinking, but still, I got that test, and it was just so many things, like, piled on to themselves in my world. And as a result, I remember walking back to camp, walking back through campus. I had an apartment on campus with a couple of my buddies, and thinking to myself, like mumbling to myself, like, this is crazy, this is crazy. I wish my father was here, I wish my father was here. And my father had died maybe 2 years before that, I think. And I remember thinking about saying that because I just felt so incredibly ungrounded and unrooted in my mind, in my body. Like, I was having, I didn't recognize them at the time, I didn't know these words, but I was having dissociative experiences where I was feeling like people around me and walking, and my body just wasn't my own in that moment. I get back to my dorm on campus, I remember I close the door, and it's like, I think it's 2:30. I look at the clock, lay down on my bed, and I'm like, this, like, what, like, I wish my father's here, I wish my father's here. And then at, the next thing I recall is, my bedroom door sounding like it's being, about to be kicked in. And I'm like, I don't, you know, what's going on? I look outside, and there are the flashlights from, like, public safety and the local town police. I'm like, that's crazy. And I open the door, and, like, two of my roommates and the school's public safety and the town police were in there, like, about to break the door down. I was like, yo, Adrian, what are you guys, like, what is this? And he was like, Femi, like, what's going on? For the last 6 hours, you've been in the room screaming and crying at the top of your lungs. And I looked at the clock, and it was 8:30. And I was like, what? And for, you know, the life of me, for $1 million, I can't tell you where I was in that time period. I don't know what happened. What I do know is that I had reached my breaking point. And the weight of the world around me found itself squarely onto my shoulders. And with no way to navigate those challenges, I had an experience very similar to that of Patakara. Very similar to what I imagine others in this room have had, and that life presses upon us. And there is suffering in this world. And without the tools to navigate that suffering, without the ability to find space and some degree of ease through the white waters of this thing called life, then we, in a very real way, are in danger of being overcome by this life. And I know if I were to pass this microphone around, we would all have stories, similar, different, worse, but we would all have our own stories of suffering, ways in which the challenges and injustices of this world have pierced, pressed, and provoked the heart. in a way that challenges us potentially to overcome and to succumb. Some of us have, in our challenges, been faced with losing loved ones, faced with challenges in our bodies, faced with challenges of all types. And the question is not, will we be challenged? Guarantee you, if the Buddha is right, we will be challenged. The question is how we respond to those challenges, like how we handle the breaking point, how we navigate when stress and suffering abounds. Regarding that, a couple of things. One is, I believe the wisdom of this world is constantly, in every moment, offering to us ways of creating greater ease in our hearts, greater space in our minds, so that we don't have to come to those breaking points regularly, where the world does not come to a grinding halt because we can't function anymore because there's just so much going on. I think that we are offered opportunities to create space and ease in our life by coming to sit in Sangha, by our practices at home, our daily meditation practices. I think that those are ways to allow ourselves to not have to go through those huge, incredible breaking moments on, like, not with any regularity, because goodness knows that that's not something that I would wish for my life or for the lives of others around me. So the decisions we make on a day-to-day basis affect the outcome of our lives on a day-to-day basis. This is the real-time definition of karma, right? The reaping and sowing of what we do. And because who we are and how we reap and sow what we do affects each moment, then each moment is a karmic act. Right? Each moment is sowing a seed. And so in this moment, I say, what is the seed that we're sowing? And we look around at our lives, and it's full of weed and crabgrass. We say, what seed have you been sowing? You know, we haven't planted, you know, rose trees and oranges, and then we get something like we get that which we sow. And sometimes that can be an empowering thought, and sometimes that can be an overwhelming thought. Like, wait a second. I am responsible for what I see in my world around me. Like, I am in some way the cause of what I see in this world around me. Yes, you are. I am. And that also is counterbalanced with the fact that there are other innumerable causes and conditions that are at play. And so those two ideas of me being having some degree of responsibility for how I move through the life and making sure I care for myself and care for this body so that I can find greater ease and kindness to this heart is a truth. And another truth is there are forces at play, other individuals and their causes and their conditions that are ripening their karma that interact with me in this mind, heart, and body. And the two are not mutually exclusive. In fact, the two inform each other. What I know is that my ability to manage that which I can manage in my own world, finding some degree of stability, some degree of ease, some degree of of calm in my world makes me more able to engage the challenges and uncertainties of the world outside of me. Right? When I'm not, when my life isn't always constantly being lived at the pace of emergency, then when emergencies do arise in the world around me, from a grounded and balanced place, the heart is more able to engage with those emergencies, those challenges, whatever it may be, those beautiful unfoldings. The heart is able to appreciate that mudita that's there. But it that takes a recognition that this life that we're living, what you do tomorrow at 7 a.m., is a karmic act. Whether we take time throughout the week for those few minutes of sitting that help to ground the heart so that when the challenges come, we're available, or whether we don't, all karmic acts all affect the outcome of this thing called life. The breaking point. One of the challenges that when I began to think like this and recognizing that I have some degree, how much we can debate on all day, but some degree of responsibility for the outcome of my life, there was almost a sense of guilt. And when I looked at the things around me, like, how is it that I can't be the cause of this chaos out here? I can't be the. It's not my fault what's going on out here. And what I often suggest is what I try to do for myself is the ability to take responsibility for the events in my life without the additional shame that often comes when things don't work out the way I want them to. Right? Can I just recognize that I have the ability to respond, that it's up to me how I'm going to navigate this thing without feeling the shame that shuts me down and keeps me from moving forward in a good way? Some degree of remorse or guilt, understandable. In fact, some degree of remorse or guilt can be quite onward leading in making the world the way we want it to be. But doing that from a space of, from a balanced and grounded heart, from a space of deep responsibility and kindness to the heart and kindness to ourselves and to the world around us. And not from a space that is so driven and fueled purely by shame, purely by what we are running away from. Kindness and compassion. Recognizing that this heart suffers, and all these hearts suffer. And we all have the little assaults to the heart all day long. And so having an appreciation for the importance of the of routine maintenance of this heart. I was recently explaining to one of my beloved white friends the importance of recognizing the role of microaggressions against brown and yellow bodies in this world. And he's a good buddy of mine, and he was like, I don't get it. Like, how come I just asked you to pass the salt and you yelled at me? And I was like, it's not this thing. It's not this. It's easy to look at this instant as an isolated event. In fact, we were actually talking about like me being followed around a store. It's easy to look at that as an isolated event, but in fact, it's not just this. If it were just this isolated event, that would be nothing. But it's the accumulation of the insults constantly and the assaulting of brown and yellow bodies that over time create that overwhelming degree of stress, so that hyper vigilance that people respond to in a way where they have reached their breaking point. Why is it when every time, I actually enjoy watching news from different views, different parts of the political spectrum. And I was watching a program not too long ago, and a person made a comment, so why is it that every time, there's any incident with a police officer and a person of color, there's all of this, these demonstrations, all of this energy around it. And, Ruth King, who came to town recently, senior teacher, senior Buddhist teacher, pretty out on the East Coast, she makes this really great point how it's not about, it's easy to see the instances that happen as single isolated instances and not see the constellation of drama and trauma in people's lives. If that man who met Patakar on the road saw her and said, he told her about the house and she responded in that way, he might have said, although this isn't in the text, without recognizing the drama and trauma that she had just been through, like, calm down, you're overreacting. Look, it's just a storm, it's gonna be okay, it's just some salt, like, just relax. But we carry in our bodies, each of us in here, black, white, green, yellow, male, female, other, we carry in our bodies the karma of what has gone on before. We carry in our bodies the stress that has led up to this moment where we reach our breaking points. And so, as we begin to wrap up, one of the things I want to leave with is the importance of really tending and honoring the heart mind in a way that we are making space for us to recognize our own woundedness, recognize the hurt that is in this heart, and to meet that hurt, meet that breaking point, meet that from a space of being really grounded, from a space of compassion, from a space of kindness, so that we don't force ourselves to try to be in a space that we're not. We allow ourselves the time and energy and space to grieve the hurts in our lives. We allow ourselves the room to really be with our own drama, our own trauma, our own harm, and meet that with as much groundedness and ease as possible, where we are becoming sources of compassion for ourselves. And in doing so, we build the muscle of compassion and we're able to be sources of compassion to meet the suffering of the world around us. Another thing I want to leave us with is the importance of doing this in community. Very important to do this on our own and have time, to sit at home. But there is a strength, a force that comes from doing this work in community, from healing in community. Again, in the words of the poet Jay-Z, you could be anywhere in the world right now, but you're here right now with us. And I appreciate that. I appreciate that there are people in this world doing their work to make this world a better place. When I first started practicing and first started going on retreats, especially people the teachers would be like, oh, thank you for your practice. Thank you for your practice. I'd be like, what is wrong with this guy? Why is he telling me thank you for my practice? I didn't pay him anything. Like, I just, thank you for my practice. But the more I practice, the more I understand and appreciate what that means. Why from one practitioner to another, we say, thank you for your practice, because as any of us practice, we are doing the work of healing for all of us. So long as there is suffering in the world, then my suffering is inextricably tied up in your suffering. Right? That's the path of the Bodhisattva. Like, we are all awakening beings, every one of us. Even your jerk best friend. And as we do our work to make the heart light, then the total suffering in the world eases up. So I believe it's an extreme act of extremely radical act to come in to the Dharma Hall and to sit in silence and to get the heart a little more ground, a little more at ease, and offering and allowing that offering to be that which we give to the world around us. In the same way, like, doing our work is liberation for all people. As a culture, we've come to a breaking point in the last year or so on many things. Very much in this Me Too moment, we have said the way that as a society we treat women is unacceptable. The breaking point of our mothers and our wives and our sisters and our friends having to endure the insults of constantly having their bodies aggressed, of having their bodies objectified, of not being treated as equals in business and so many other endeavors. As a society, we said, this is enough is enough. There is a breaking point, and now we get to see how we move forward from that breaking point. Now, because we have recognized that we no longer allow that to be the case, the old way of doing things is on its way out. We still have room to work, right? It's on its way out. In the same way, much healing, much balance, much beauty came from Patakara's breaking point. I believe in so many ways how we treat people of all stripes, colors, sexual orientations, genders. I believe that is on its way of changing and evolving, because as a society we have broken around this and said, we are moving forward. And so the last thing I'll say as we open it up for just a couple minutes of Q&A is that we want this world to be beautiful. We want this world to be peaceful. We want rainbows and unicorns. We want many wonderful things for this world. And there are only two people in this world. You can see this pointing with one finger, which is why I'm not in mathematics school. Medical school. There are only two people in this world that can change this world. Only two. And that is me, and that is you. I'm the only people that can change this world. We can want him or her to do it. We can want anyone, but the only people that can change the world are me and you. And so by doing this practice, we are embodying, we are becoming the change that we want to see in this world. And that is, for me, the heart of the Dharma. Ashe. So we got about 14 seconds for questions. Who's going? There's like one or two questions. I don't know. We got Yokai?
Yeah.
Q&A time?
Yeah, a couple minutes.
All right, you cut me off when,
because okay.
You know I like to talk. So, all right. Any questions or thoughts, reflections, anything? Lynn. Good. Hope there's nothing else that needs to be spoken into the room right now. Let's just take a moment. I'll drop all the words and sit for a minute.